ever. The entire town of Armero was obliterated, buried under as much as 30 feet of mud. The authorities here are concerned that the rising temperatures in the vicinity of the volcano could once again melt the snow and ice and unleash floods and mudslides. This morning, they ordered the evacuation of 2,500 people living near the volcano. In Bogota, I'm Tom Gelton.
The Environmental Protection Agency is phasing out use of the farm chemical Alar over the next 2 years. The EPA today said its two-year phase-out was designed to allow farmers to sell fruit that's already been treated with the chemical. Baseball Commissioner Bart Giamatti is dead. He suffered a massive heart attack today at his vacation home in Edgartown, Massachusetts, on the island of Martha's Vineyard. An ambulance team picked up Giamatti around mid-afternoon. He was unconscious, and efforts to revive him failed. Baseball Commissioner Bart Giamatti, dead at 51 years of age. I'm Michael Richards, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. During the 8 years Edmund Pat Brown was governor of California, he knew he was the last stop on the road to the gas chamber for convicts on death row. He sent 36 of them to death and commuted the sentence of 23 others. Now the 84-year-old former governor has written a book reflecting on the awesome responsibility of making these decisions of life, death, and justice, and how during his years in office he came to oppose capital punishment. His book is called Public Justice, Private Mercy, A Governor's Education on Death Row. It's co-authored with Dick Adler. Brown was the Democratic governor of California from 1959 to 67 when he lost the election to Ronald Reagan. Brown's son Jerry Brown also served 8 years as governor of the state. Pat Brown now practices law in Los Angeles. He's been out of office for 22 years, but his death row decisions still haunt him.
You never forget them when you think that you had 60 lives where if you said thumbs up, they lived, thumbs down, they died. It's a terrific responsibility. You're governor, you have many responsible actions that you have to take, but this is more acute. I mean, it's closer to, you know, to life and death.
You say that you made your first visit to San Quentin's death row just last year. Why did it take you so long, and why did you end up going last year?
I can't tell you why. I visited the prisons, Folsom Prison and the other prisons of the state, but death row, I just didn't want to go. I wanted to read about it. I mean, read the reports that were made. I wanted to make an objective decision, but to go to death row and walk over there and see all those human beings who had been convicted by a jury of their peers and a judge had refused to grant them a new trial, and then the Supreme Court had affirmed their judgment, and they were all sentenced to die. I just didn't want to see them. Maybe it was cowardice, maybe it was something else.
Can you give us a sense, when you were governor, how a case would come to you for you to decide whether you would grant clemency or not?
Well, in the death penalty cases, I waited until the inmate or the condemned had exhausted all of his appeals in the court. In other words, he'd been tried by a jury. The Supreme Court of the state of California had affirmed it because death penalty cases go directly to the Supreme Court. Then what the prisoners would do during my administration, and it's gotten, there have been more of them since I left, they would then start in the with a writ of habeas corpus, alleging something that hadn't been hadn't been alleged in the appeal brief, and then they'd start all over again, and they'd go up to the Supreme Court, and finally, after they'd exhausted all their appeals, there was no other recourse except the pardoning power of the governor. Then I would review the case. I'd have a hearing, usually a week before the execution, and I would try, very frankly, to find some reason to commute it from death to life. And I did in, I can't remember, I think 22 or 23 cases, and I let 40 or 38 go to their death.
When you became the governor of California, you thought that the death penalty was a necessary evil, yet within 1 month of you being the governor, you commuted the sentence of John Crooker, who was convicted of murdering his wife. Why did you agree to hear that case?
Well, that was the first death penalty case that I had. It wasn't his wife. It was his It was the woman that he was living with. Matter of fact, he was working for this woman and going to law school at UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles. And then she terminated the relationship. And one night when she was out in a party, this woman with where he'd been living and taking care of her children and doing the housework and things like that, he waited in the closet for her to come back, begged her to come back. She wouldn't do it. He went out in the kitchen, got a knife, brought it in, said, "If you don't come back, I'll kill you." And I commuted his sentence because if he'd gone there with a weapon, if he had a weapon in his hand, a gun, and killed her, then I would have considered the premeditation that he planned to do it. But the fact that he went in there without a weapon of any kind, went out into the kitchen and got the knife, brought it in when she came in late at night, and when she refused to come back, killed her, I just felt that there was not sufficient premeditation to warrant the death penalty. And I think he served 8 or 9 years after that, finally got out, and he's lived a worthwhile life since that time.
Now, the decision that you made to commute the sentence of John Crooker was ultimately a very, I think, gratifying decision. He went on to marry, raise a family. He wrote a play. He visited you, wrote you several letters, and it sounded like he'd become, you know, a very responsible citizen after he was paroled from prison. You had an experience, though, that was the opposite of that, and you call this your worst mistake. Edward Simon Wien.
Edward Simon Wien got the death penalty, not for murdering a woman or murdering anybody else, but for kidnapping. And the kidnapping consists of going to the person's home. The woman would advertise sewing machine, something for sale, and he'd go in response to that ad. And when she opened the door, he said, "My wife unfortunately can't be here, but would you show her to me? And then I'll bring my wife back later if I like it." And then the woman would show him the whatever she was selling in the house, vacuum cleaner, sewing machine, or whatever it was. He'd drop something on the floor and say, "I can't see very well. Will you help me?" And the woman would bend over to help him find it on the floor. He would then take out a knife, take her into the bedroom, and rape her. And then he would steal her purse. So there was it was a case of kidnapping with a consideration. And he got the death penalty, even though he didn't kill anybody. He had, I think, 9 or 10 cases like that. And that was the reason I commuted him, because there was he hadn't murdered anybody. He had kidnapped them, somewhat technically, I thought, and moving them from the living room to the bedroom. But that was the reason that I did it. Then he got out after, I don't know, 20 years in prison, did it again, and this time he killed a woman. The only one of the 23 cases that I commuted where there was any further incident of any kind. And it's a remarkable record, but even today, as I'm talking with you, I wonder whether I shouldn't let all 23 of them die to save that poor woman's life that he killed.
What were you doing when you found out, this was after you were in office, when you found out that Edward Simon Wien, whose sentence you had commuted, had gotten out and had killed?
I can't remember, but I can remember being on a plane one day going from Sacramento to Los Angeles, and somebody in the opposite seat read in the paper as we were sitting there that day and said to me, "It's your fault that this woman was killed," and called it to my attention. I didn't know who he was. I've never seen him since, but it was a shocking accusation that he made, and it's bothered me all the days of my life.
My guest is Pat Brown, the former governor of California, who's written a new book called Public Justice, Private Mercy, A Governor's Education on Death Row. Do you feel that you are somehow responsible for this woman's death?
Yes, I do. I feel that that Wien should have gone to the gas chamber, although I think the reasons that I commuted him were valid. I mean, the fact that he hadn't taken the woman, taken her out of the house. He'd moved her from the living room to the bedroom. And that was a pretty technical case of kidnapping, although the Supreme Court held that it was. And the Supreme Court was a very excellent court, very good court. And I suppose I should have followed their judgment. But I think if you will objectively look at the governor and the powers that they give him, the pardoning powers, that this was a case of life imprisonment without possibility of parole rather than execution in the gas chamber. Who knows? I mean, it's. I look back on the judgments I made as governor, and I certainly don't feel that that I was a supreme being of any kind. They were tough. They're tough today when I look back on them. They were tough when I wrote this book.
This is exactly the kind of thing that can shake somebody's faith. You had been against the death penalty, I believe, by the time Ween murdered a woman after he got out of jail. Did that murder shake your faith in your own position, in your own opposition to the death penalty?
No, I don't think so. I think the death penalty is fundamentally wrong. If you could show, not by an overwhelming evidence, by any evidence that the death penalty prevented other people from killing, I'd be for it. I mean, it would be self-defense. I mean, it was the state against the individual to try to protect the lives of innocent people. But in states where they've abolished the death penalty, where they only have life imprisonment, you have fewer homicides than you have in states where they have the death penalty. Now, this is not very good evidence, but it's some evidence. And if you drop these people in a prison, tried the cases immediately, and had the appeals given priority, I think you'd have less homicides than you have today, where these cases go on and on and on. There are now in the death row at San Quentin some 220 people, and some of them have been there 8, 9 years. I can't tell you what the longest is, but all of them are over. Not all of them, because there's recent people that have been sent to death row. They're all long, long cases, and I'm telling you that if a person with a loaded gun knew that he was going to get life imprisonment, no possibility of parole, I think it would be just as advantageous as the death penalty that we have in California and in other states.
As I mentioned before, when you became governor, you thought that the death penalty was a necessary evil. By the time you left office, you changed your mind. What was responsible for that change of mind?
Well, I looked at the at cases in other states. I looked at the cases in California where they had given the person life imprisonment. Then I looked at the people they gave the death penalty, and I concluded that that there wasn't any rationale, there wasn't any reason for it. It was just the feeling of 12 jurors in a particular case. And then I looked at the long delays. There weren't delays, the long delays when I was governor. I think the longest case was, of course, the Chessman case that went on and on and on. But most of them were 2 or 3 years. Now there are 220 people in death row. I mean, they've been going on. And I think the statements that I made when I asked for the repeal of the death penalty in California in 1960, I think the statements I made at that time have been corroborated by the history of what's happened.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Pat Brown. He was the governor of California from 1959 to 1967. And during those 8 years, 59 convicts were scheduled for execution. He allowed 36 to die in the gas chamber and granted clemency to 23. He reflects on those decisions and on the death penalty in his new book, Public Justice, Private Mercy, A Governor's Education on Death Row. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Speaking with Pat Brown, the former governor of California. There were two times that you mentioned in your new book, once while you were governor and once right before you took office, that a temporary stay of execution was phoned in just 1 or 2 minutes too late when the gas had already been turned on in the gas chamber and the convict wasn't yet dead, but there was already enough gas in the room so that they would be dead soon. There was no way of dispelling the rest of the gas. Even if they opened up the room to let it out, they'd be endangering the lives of the people in the next room. How did you respond to that?
Well, the first case, I think, was when I was Attorney General, and it was Governor Knight, my predecessor, as governor. The second case was one that I had denied clemency, and they'd then gone to a judge, a federal judge, and he was meditating. He tried to get the warden of the prison where the man was being executed on the phone, but they had the wrong number or something, but they didn't get him. Those were tragic cases, although I don't think in either of the cases that Governor Knight would have granted clemency, or in the case in California that I would have.
Did you ask the warden, I guess, to schedule the executions just a few minutes after the hour they were officially scheduled for, to allow for this kind of last-minute change?
Yes, I did. They were sentenced to death at 10 o'clock in the morning in every case, usually on a Friday morning. I think there were one or two exceptions to it. But I asked the warden to wait 2 or 3 minutes. But you got to remember, this condemned has been in, he's been in condemned row for maybe 20 or 25 months, and then he's been down in death cell, which is about 13 steps from the gas chambers, and it's pretty cruel punishment those last hours of the condemned, and so you can't wait too long, and when 10 o'clock comes and no action has taken place, the quicker you do it, the better it is for this man that's going to die. Although as I talk about these things, it all seems kind of cruel as I talk with you today about it, whether they live at 2 minutes after 10 or they're executed promptly at 10. It doesn't sound very good to me.
During the 8 years that you were governor and that you were the final stop for people who were on death row, did you feel you ever used your power opportunistically, looking back now?
You mean for political reasons?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I suppose in every person that I denied the death penalty, I did it because I was afraid there'd be political repercussions. Because I didn't, that was one reason. The other reason was, I had sworn to uphold all the laws of the state of California. The death penalty was one of the laws that I swore to uphold. And if I, just because I didn't believe in the death penalty, substituted my judgment for that of the people of the state and the legislature, I think that would have been a perversion of my duties as governor. So I didn't do it.
You had to deal with a lot of public pressure when you were governor of California from both sides, the people who supported capital punishment and the people who opposed it. Was either side more effectual in swaying you? And do you feel that you were ever swayed by public pressure?
No, I don't think so. I really realized, and I don't mean to be holy about this thing, but I really realized that a human life was at stake, number one. Number two, the people had enacted the laws calling for the execution of people that killed. And that was a terrific responsibility on their part. And I tried my level best, and to do what the right thing and follow the law and my own conscience. That sounds a little bit moralistic, but that's the way I feel about it.
When you were governor, did you have a sense that the public was for capital punishment? Or?
Yes, they had several polls. They had by the field poll, which has taken over the state of California, and the people overwhelmingly favored the death penalty. Not as much as they do today, because there hasn't been an execution in California. But then it was about 61 or 62% for the death penalty and about 38% against it. People believe in the death penalty. They think that when a person takes a life, that they have the right to kill this person, number one. They think they have the right to execute a killer. And in addition to that, I think the average human being believes the death penalty is a deterrent. And all the argument in the world doesn't convince them. I've never convinced one person that believes in the death penalty that he's wrong. So it's one of those things that'll be determined only after they've executed about 200 people in California. When they start killing them every Friday, four or five of them every Friday for 50 weeks, I think they may get their belly full of the death penalty and decide to substitute life imprisonment. They may get tired of the expense and the long delays in carrying out the death penalty. I think all of these reasons will accumulate, and then we'll get rid of it.
Did you ever feel when you commuted a sentence that you had to respond to the families of the victim?
Yes, I did. I'd received letters criticizing me by the family of the victim, and I would try to write a letter explaining why I did it. It probably didn't do any good, but I felt a duty to respond to the family who wanted that person executed.
In our discussion about the death penalty and capital punishment, we've been keeping it on a kind of legal level and the level of responsibility. I was wondering if there's a religious element in your feelings about capital punishment.
No, I'm not a very good Roman Catholic, but I am a Catholic and proud of it. But I think you'll find priests, clergy, people that students of the Bible that both ways. I think it's a matter. I don't think it's a religious question. I think it's a question of a person's individual morality or sense of morals.
If there is to be capital punishment, which you oppose, but if there is capital punishment as there is now, do you think that the governor should maintain the right to issue clemency, to pardon? To issue clemency and reverse the death penalty.
I think that that for one person to have that power over life and death, and particularly a political person, and a governor is always a political person, that it should be given to maybe a commission of three people, not peace officers who would believe in the death penalty, but three citizens, a bipartisan commission of Republicans and Democrats, maybe three people who'd had some experience in dealing with human affairs, maybe educators or sociologists or doctors or psychiatrists or psychologists, three with their duties defined before their appointment. I think it'd be better than having a political person make a judgment in those cases. It's too tough. People feel too strongly about it, and you can be a great governor and make the mistake of commuting someone who the people want executed, and you're gone. The governor of New Mexico commuted 6 or 7 people, and it hurt him politically. He did it as he left office, so it didn't have any effect upon him. But there was, I think, the governor of Massachusetts commuted several sentences, and he was defeated, never elected again, and he was a good governor, too.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, too.
Pat Brown's new book is Public Justice, Private Mercy, A Governor's Education on Death Row. It's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Brown was the governor of California from 1959 to 1967. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The blues musician Leadbelly was in prison in Louisiana in the 1930s when he wrote a song to the governor O.K. Allen pleading to be pardoned. He was released in 1934. He later sang about the experience.
I sung it all up in 1934. And the first day of July, the good school kind boy, better known as Mr. John A. Lomax, and his son, better known as Mr. Andy Lomax, they come down on Angola, it was raining one Sunday. And he told me that the song that you made about Governor O.K. Allen, if you sing it through my microphone, I'd take it to Governor O.K. Allen for you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Rolling Stones are back together on tour, and they have a new album. We're listening to some of it now. Coming up, a review of the new Rolling Stones record by rock critic Ken Tucker. Lee Grant's acting has won her Emmys, the Oscar, and an Obie. Although she hasn't given up acting, in the last few years she's devoted more of her time to directing. We talk about her new documentary on battered women. And there's mystery and terror at the bottom of a grave in rural England. Critic Maureen Corrigan reviews First Light, the new suspense novel from British writer Peter Ackroyd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is cutting diplomatic relations with Panama, issuing a statement today describing the new government that was sworn in today as illegal, and charging that there will be no improvement in relations as long as General Noriega is in power. Neil Conan has more on the story.
The presidential statement simply formalized U.S. policy of the past 18 months. Following General Noriega's indictment by two Florida grand juries in February 1988, then-President Eric Arturo Del Valle tried to fire his armed forces chief, only to find himself deposed instead. Noriega installed Manuel Solis Palma to fill out Del Valle's term, which ran out last night, and State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler made it clear that the Bush administration is not impressed with the new provisional president, Francisco Rodriguez.
Noriega's latest puppet president is an unknown within Panama with no political following, whose chief qualification for the position seems to have been his long-time friendship with Noriega and his slavish loyalty to the dictator.
No new sanctions on Panama were announced today, but the president's statement said further measures are under consideration. This is Neil Conan reporting.
50 years ago today, Nazi Germany invaded Poland, plunging the world into its Second World War. Today, West German Chancellor Kohl said Germany had done terrible things during the war years, and not all the wounds have healed. Roger Carell of the BBC reports.
Chancellor Kohl said Germans felt sorrow at the untold suffering inflicted on people and nations in their name by Hitler's criminal regime. No one could question Germany's guilt for starting the war. He said dreadful things have been done to the Polish people, but he called for reconciliation. Germany's relationship with Israel and with Jews throughout the world showed that even abysses could be bridged. However, he said reconciliation could only be possible if the whole truth was spoken, and part of that truth was that more than 2 million Germans had perished as refugees or expellees from the newly enlarged Poland after the war. Chancellor Kohl wished Poland's new Prime Minister success and promised that West Germany would abide by the 1970 treaty between the two countries, which recognizes Poland's post-war borders.
Roger Carell of the BBC. Baseball Commissioner Abe Bartlett Giamatti died this afternoon after suffering a heart attack. He was 51 years old. Giamatti had gone to his home on Martha's Vineyard this morning. It was just over a week ago the commissioner was in the national spotlight when he barred manager Pete Rose of the Cincinnati Reds from baseball because of his betting habits. A chain smoker who once said that cigarettes were his primary vice, Giamatti had been involved in the Rose investigation for 6 months. He had been National League president and president of Yale University before becoming baseball commissioner. On Wall Street, the market closed at a record high, the Dow Jones Industrial closing at 2,752. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. For much of the 80s, the story of the Rolling Stones has been dissension among the ranks, everybody doing their own projects. The Stones are now reconstituted, out on tour with a new album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Steel Wheels.
Yeah, well, they're not the only ones with mixed emotions. I have them too about this new Stones album. On the one hand, it's a heck of a lot of fun hearing these old geezers having a heck of a lot of fun. They're working hard, they're wheezing their way through rock and roll these days, but they sound exhilarated by their effort, and that's no small accomplishment. Sad, Sad, Sad is an example of the middle-aged Rolling Stones operating at full throttle, but it's a pace they can't sustain anymore. A decade ago, they could still do it on an album like Some Girls. 15 years ago, they were able to use their jaded experience to sustain the druggy, bad trip masterpiece Exile on Main Street. These days, you frequently have to take the Stones' skills in bits and pieces. For example, forget what Mick Jagger is singing on a song called Almost Hear You Sigh. Instead, listen to the sound of Charlie Watts hitting a drum, because it's a wonderful elemental sound. Steel Wheels arrives at a depressing time for rock and roll veterans. This has been an appalling summer, dominated by the spectacle of pop musicians past their prime raking in big bucks. All sorts of groups are exploiting nostalgia for greed of varying degrees of venality. In this context, the Rolling Stones tour that begins this week certainly seems more promising than, say, the Doobie Brothers' Let's Milk the Fans reunion, and less noble than the Who's We're Giving a Chunk to Charity outing. This isn't the Rolling Stones' fault, I suppose, except to the extent that these clever businessmen have decided that now's the time to stop all that feuding stuff in favor of one big final score. In this sense, all the new group photographs I've seen of Mick and Keith and the boys remind me of William Holden and Ernest Borgnine and the Wild Bunch. That's Continental Drift, with exotic instrumentation provided by the master musicians of Jujuka, the group that the late Rolling Stone Brian Jones first collaborated with some 20 years ago. That song, with its sinuous jazz structure, is intended to show us that the Stones still have a few surprises up their sleeves. But the only truly surprising thing about Steel Wheels is the extent to which Keith Richards has become the heart and soul of this band. Mick Jagger's phrasing is admirably witty, and the way he wiggles his bottom in the video for the album's first single, Mixed Emotions, is extremely knowingly funny. But Jagger's sense of humor is steeped in irony, and unfortunately, rock and roll OD'd on irony a decade ago. We just don't need any more of it. What we do need is honest emotionalism, and the only time the Rolling Stones locate this quality on Steel Wheels is when Keith sings the album's most undeniably beautiful and heartfelt song, Slipping Away.
Yes, it's just another. Draw a breath.
Listening to that song, you can almost believe that it offers the image of the Rolling Stones dropping their naughty boy facade, of coming clean for a change, of admitting that this mixture of rock and blues and soul means a hell of a lot to them, and that they still desperately yearn to inspire that same feeling in us.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Grant was a successful film, TV, and stage actress before she took up directing. As an actress, she won an Oscar for her supporting role in the 1975 film Shampoo. Now she acts in between directing projects. Her first feature film was an adaptation of the Tilly Olson story, Tell Me a Riddle. She also directed the popular TV movie Nobody's Child, starring Marlo Thomas. She's directed and produced four documentaries for HBO. The latest is on battered women, and it airs this month. Grant narrates the documentary and conducts the interviews, but stays off camera.
I'm not up there to push myself. I'm there because I want what I'm exploring to come as freshly to the people who are seeing it as it is to me at that moment. Don't forget, in any of these areas that I've explored, whether it was Down and Out in America, or whether it was Battered, this was not a place I'd been to before. This was not ground that I'd covered. I'm on a journey the same way as the people who are watching it, and it was a journey of revelation to me. This particular journey told me more about relationships that I'd had that had been mysteriously missing in links to me, and for the first time I understood, you know, what my role and what the role of the guy was that I never understood before.
This is from the new movie you got that?
From Battered, yeah.
But does that mean you'd been abused yourself, or is it things different than that, but insights that you got from talking to?
I've never been battered.
Uh-huh.
I've never been hit. But I've been controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And the base of battering is control.
You're talking about emotional control.
Emotional control. At a certain point, you give over control. I don't know when that point is, but there is a point when you give over control to another person in your life and do what they say. And I had a relationship like that, and I never understood what it was all about until I was explained by the men's counselor, Michael, the various ways that these batterers use to control the women in their lives.
Did you get out of that relationship that you were in that you realized was emotionally abusive?
Not at all. I was left.
Uh-huh.
And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Just the best thing. He left me and I got back on my feet and went to work again, which he didn't permit me to do. And by the time he wanted me back, I had friends there who took one arm and took another arm and would not let me go back into that pit again. They stopped me. I would have gone back in, because you're the habit of living out that kind of parent-child, and I must say that it really is an extension of a student, teacher, parent, child. It's that first relationship that you go into where you want the man to sweep you off your feet. You want him to be dangerous. You want him to boss you around and tell you what to do. And most of the women that you saw in this documentary said, oh, he was so sexy. He was so hot. He was so, you know, attractive. And he concentrated on me 24 hours a day. He told me what to do. He told me the way to chew my food. He told me the way to walk. And from being ignored, suddenly they had this constant attention to themselves all the time. The fact that the constant attention started to work out to be, I hate the way you walk. I hate the way you chew your food. You don't do this and don't do that, is what turned into the nightmare. But it started out as their dream.
I want to ask you about something that you once wrote about in an article in the New York Times. This was years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The article was about the differences for you between living in New York and living in Hollywood. And you were talking about acting in Hollywood for movies mm-hmm. and how you really like to do your own makeup.
Yeah.
But there was this cameraman who would get very upset, and he wanted the official makeup person to do your makeup. So you finally took the cameraman aside and you said to them, well, that the reason why you couldn't let this guy do your makeup is that once a makeup man had raped you, and
right.
that now you felt you could never let a makeup man touch you again.
Uh-huh.
And I think you wept a little bit.
Yes.
And the cameraman was very understanding, and that was the end of that. You made up the story, though, right?
Yeah, of course I made it up.
why did you do that?
Why? Because I just come out from New York, and I'd seen the show, and I thought that all the women on the show just looked terrible. I'd just come off a blacklist, and I needed desperately to make it in Hollywood. It was my new career, and I was not going to let this old guy, who the cameraman said did Joan Crawford, and wanted to put her lips on me, do my makeup. It was my sense of survival, and every day that I showed up on the set, work stopped, the crew stood around, the cameraman said, you mean you're not going to let this man, this professional, do your makeup? You mean you're going to insult him in this way? Let him go and put your rouge on. And I stood there surrounded by the crew and the cameraman every day and said no. But it was hell. It was just, it was really hell. And I go home at night and I cry and go in the next day, and it happened. We were shooting one night, and it came to me that the only way was not to, say no and confront it, but to make up some story that would get to him. And the minute I said it, you know, his hand, arm that had been around me because he thought I was going to say, I'm sorry, he can do my makeup from now on, you know. When I said I was raped by a makeup man, you know, his hand flew up. He went out. He said, nobody touch this girl. Nobody go near her again. And, of course, all the tension, I was so pent up from all those days of being hated on that set and not talked to and surrounded and being a pariah. I was crying from just, you know, the sheer, I don't know what.
But let me ask you, now that you've done this movie with women who had been raped and abused by their husbands, do you have any regrets at all about
making up
a rape story? Yeah.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. You know, you do what you can, kid. You know, we all have to get along in this world.
Early in your career, you had great critical success in both the stage and screen versions of Detective Story.
Mm-hmm.
But then from 1952 to 1964, you virtually didn't work because you were blacklisted. I think this was in part because your husband, the writer Arnold Manoff, had refused to testify to UAC. Were you blacklisted because of your husband?
I was blacklisted because of my husband. I was also blacklisted because at that time I spoke at the memorial of an actor who I'd worked with in my husband's play, actually, J. Edward Bromberg, and said that I thought that he died because the Un-American Activities Committee hounded him and harassed him, and he had a heart attack. And the next day, my name was in Red Channels and Aware. I don't know whether you know that those are
mm-hmm.
those are the organizations that listed actors. And when your name is in there, you can't work again. And so It was a choice I made. I was asked to speak at that memorial, and I knew in speaking at it, even though I was very young at the time, I think it was 19 at the time, I knew what the chances were that this would happen to me, but it was still a shock when, you know, it's a funny thing. There's something in us that says, but it's for a good reason, but I told the truth. How can they punish me for telling the truth? Well, that's the world, and that was my first lesson in the world, and those are the chances that you take.
Just looking back now, how do you think it affected your life to spend 12 years as a young actress barred from your profession?
It affected my life in every kind of basic way that it possibly could, both for the bad and for the good. One minute, as you say, I had enormous acclaim in my first play and first film. I was nominated for an Academy Award. I'd won the Cannes Film Festival Award as Best Actress. And that same year, by the time the award arrived, I could not work in films or television. On the other hand, it happened to a girl who had never read a newspaper in her life. So that the education of Lee Grant started with the blacklist. And I joined a struggle to do something about it. Those 12 years were spent fighting the people who imposed the blacklist on artists, and I think made me a director, because the only way I could earn a living was to teach. And it gave me a very solid grounding in breaking things down, in knowing how to work with other people. And I think it was like the base for the turn into directing.
Well, Lee Grant, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Battered, directed by Lee Grant, debuts September 13th on HBO. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We are continuing with our remembrances of the beginning of the Second World War. We're talking today about the Polish invasion, with a German soldier who was part of the invading force, and with Polish people who were in the path of the German army as they came in. As you know, Bishop Tutu of South Africa has been arrested. We'll have a story on that. Panama has installed a puppet government. Noriega still rules, and the United States has canceled our diplomatic relations with Panama. We'll have more on that as well.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Peter Ackroyd is a British author who's written an acclaimed biography of T.S. Eliot and several novels that critic Maureen Corrigan says make the familiar strange. She has a review of Ackroyd's new novel, First Light.
Peter Ackroyd writes hypnotic novels about the intersection of the past with the present. In his 1987 book, Chatterton, Ackroyd imagines that the poet of that name, who committed suicide two centuries ago, exerts an ominous influence over his present-day admirers. Ackroyd's earlier novel, Hawksmoor, tells the story of a man at a London construction site who becomes possessed by the diabolical spirit of an 18th-century architect. In his new novel, First Light, Ackroyd locates this eerie mingling of past and present inside our own bodies. As one character in the novel reminds another, all the materials of life come from cosmic trace elements. Our bodies are built with the fossilized debris of dead stars, which ceased to exist millions of years before the Earth was formed. Who needs Voyager 2's pictures of Neptune when you can encounter the prehistoric cosmos simply by looking in your bathroom mirror? In First Light, Ackroyd moves from poetry and architecture to archaeology, a perfect subject for a novelist who believes that the dead surround the living. The novel opens with the discovery of a Neolithic grave in a farmer's field in Dorset. As archaeologists begin to excavate the site, An astronomer at a nearby observatory witnesses the strange reappearance of the ancient night sky. For comic relief, Aykroyd deposits some buffoonish characters at the gravesite. Among them are Joey Hanover and his wife Floey, who are retired music hall entertainers, and farmer Mint and his son, Boy Mint, whose conversations revolve around sheep bones and rat traps. But like the comic gravediggers in Hamlet, these characters, even as they're distracting us with their nonsense, are also leading us deeper into the gloomy secrets beneath the Dorset earth. Aykroyd's narrative is like one of those Russian dolls. Stories are nested within stories, and the plot resembles the maze-like interior of the Neolithic grave itself. At first, the archaeologists believe they found the grave of an ancient astronomer because of astrological markings on its entrance. Then they break through a terminal wall of the tomb and discover the fading ashes of a hanged man. It's a warning to abandon the project, but they don't. The removal of another false wall reveals that the tomb is in fact a chamber grave whose secrets extend far beneath the hillside. All of these blind passages, detours, and misleading hieroglyphics make for a suspenseful journey through the tomb, but they're also Aykroyd's way of frustrating those readers who'll try too hard to decode his book. Aykroyd wants us to accept, not to solve, mysteries. As one of his astronomers says while meditating on the vastness of the universe, all we can do is make up our own stories. We could only see the entire pattern if we were outside it, and in that case, we would have ceased to exist. The story of tombs and stars that Peter Aykroyd has made up in First Light is weird and compelling, and designed for those readers who won't mind feeling their way through the dark.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed First Light by Peter Aykroyd. It's published by Grove Weidenfeld. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and arts commentaries. Ed Doherty and Joan Tuohy edit and mix the reviews and interviews. I'm Terry Gross, and it's good to welcome back the listeners of West Virginia Public Radio Network.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the man who brought Miss Piggy and the Cookie Monster to life and directed Steve Martin and Michael Caine in the comedy Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Muppeteer-turned-filmmaker Frank Oz. And Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart plays us some of the world music he's recorded on his travels. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.